Good morning. Zbigniew Zielinski here, standing in for Marian Richardson.
We have to announce, unfortunately, the sad news, a breaking story, but the sad news of the death of Seamus Heaney, the Nobel Prize-winning Irish poet laureate who has died at the age of 74. We will be staying on the...
President Michael D. Higgins led the tributes to the poet.
I've been thinking about it since I got the terrible sad news, because it's only just very recently that I met Seamus Heaney with Michael Longley. I was present when they both read at the opening of Court in Galway. And as I thought about it, I thought of Seamus Heaney's chuckle. There was a kind of chuckle he would make. And, you know, behind that was a knowledge of old things and new things and strange things. I think that without a doubt Seamus's poetry had benefited from the very early acquaintance he had with Latin and with Irish. You knew when meeting him there was what I would call a Heaney presence, and behind the smile there was an extraordinary, wonderful, deep, generous and compassionate scholarship. And yes, it is a mark of genius to have that, and to be able to, which I read, so important to so many people, to be able to deliver it all with such grace. Always with Seamus was Mary, and I just feel, while all of us will miss, as I even describe it, the extraordinary personality of Seamus for Mary and his children, theirs is the greatest loss, of course. And I so from my heart send on behalf of everybody our sympathy and solidarity to her and them.
Here's Seamus Heaney reading his poem Midterm Break.
I sat all morning in the college sick bay, counting bells, nailing classes to a close. At 2 o'clock, our neighbours drove me home. In the porch, I met my father crying. He had always taken funerals in his stride, and Big Jim Evans saying it was a hard blow. The baby cooed and laughed and rocked the pram when I came in, and I was embarrassed by old men standing up to shake my hand and tell me they were sorry for my trouble. Whispers informed strangers I was the eldest away at school, as my mother held my hand in hers and coughed out angry, tearless sighs. At 10 o'clock, the ambulance arrived with the corpse, stanched and bandaged by the nurses. Next morning, I went up into the room. Snowdrops and candles soothed the bedside. I saw him for the first time in 6 weeks. Paler now, wearing a poppy bruise on his left temple, he lay in the 4-foot box as in his cot. No gaudy scars. The bumper knocked him clear. A 4-foot box, a foot for every year.
Former President Mary Robinson shared her reaction to the sad news with Richard Crowley.
I remember one particular example of Seamus, and that was the announcement of the Nobel Prize in 1995. If you recall, Seamus and Mary were lost in a remote part of Greece with friends, and they were sought, of course, by journalists, and the story kept growing. And then we got a call to the Oris from Seamus, asking us to help him to come home. And he came straight from the airport to the Oris with Mary and with their 3 children, with Michael, Christopher and Catherine Ann. And there was a short press conference. And then we all adjourned to a private room where we laughed together at the whole situation. And then Seamus had this rueful look on his face, and he kept telling deprecating stories about himself, so that we laughed more and more. And that also was the man, very humble in many senses, aware of his talent, there's no doubt about that, of the fact that he had this wonderful creative ability. And yet he was such an easy person, and that's, I think, why he became part of Irish life. There's a famous poem now called From the Republic of Conscience, which he gifted to Amnesty in 1988 for the 40th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. I've quoted that poem so many times to law students and others, and it became the basis for the award which Amnesty now gives called Ambassador of Conscience, which has been given to many people now in the world, always reflecting that poem of Seamus Heaney's.
Broadcaster John Kelly was a friend of Seamus Heaney.
This is a massive shock, and actually I'm just sitting, I'm in my office at home here, and I'm looking at my desk. There's an envelope here he sent me a couple of weeks ago. I was writing something myself, and I emailed him and said, do you remember what colour the American GI is? What colour was their uniform? Because I wanted to check that with him, because he would have remembered them from when he was a kid. And he sent me a book written by a cousin of his. And there's an envelope with the handwriting and the address and everything on it. All that's so familiar to me. He would do anything for you, incredibly kind. I remember once going on holiday and forgotten a driver's license, and he went round to my place and he got a key and he FedExed this and this kind of stuff. He'd do all those sorts of things for you. He'd always have an encouraging word, if things weren't going well in your job or something like that. The letter would arrive straight, wishing you well and all that kind of stuff. So a man who took great care of people, took great care of writers, of younger writers.
Poet Theo Dorgan also remembered Seamus Heaney on News at One.
In one of the tributes today, Seamus Heaney's name is put in there with Joyce and Yeats and Shaw and Beckett. Now, how would he react to that sort of description of himself?
With a deep guttural derry, ach, 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 of half embarrassment, but he deserved it. He is there. And John Montagu has a lovely line, the dark permanence of ancient forms. I think Seamus's work has already passed into the dark permanence of ancient forms. But he did an extraordinary thing as well. He was immensely loved. Everywhere he went, I had the pleasure of organising readings from the pleasure of being at far more readings than I had a hand in myself. And every time he came out, there was that audible strengthening in people. You could feel people straighten up and strengthen themselves. And people just beamed at him. Because in some mysterious way, he was all that is best in us. He had, I think more than any other poet I've ever met, genuine humility. He had the humility of somebody who knew that the gift was just that, a gift. Poetry matters in the strangest and most unexpected of places in this country, because poetry is language trying to be clean and clear and tell the truth. So that sense of service to the language, of service to his people, I think it earned him perhaps the greatest of accolades that would have meant most to him. You know that we have an ordinary phrase we use. We save somebody. He was one of us. But we say it with pride and with a sense that we ourselves are amplified and strengthened by it. Well, Seamus was one of us.
Thomas Delaney is a Dublin taxi driver who called Liveline to remember his encounter with Seamus Heaney.
Where did you take him?
I brought him up to Meridian Square about a year ago, maybe more. And when he got out, we were talking, and I said, I've written some poetry, I have a book of poetry I've written. Would you care to have a copy? He said, I certainly would. So I handed it to him and made back for the driver's side of the car. He said, where are you going? I said, there's a problem. He said, yes. He said, you better sign this book.
Did you inscribe it, and did you wish him?
I just signed it from Mr. Seamus Heaney, poet, from Thomas Delaney, the author. If I may. Mm-hmm. I wrote something I only heard about the death at 1 o'clock, if I have time.
Please go ahead.
Heaney Seamus. A sad passing of a poet great, a sudden demise leading eyes in mournful cries. He will be remembered at every poetic debate, for he brought together north and south divides. Generosity flowed in his veins, the passion in his blood pushed his pen. Indelible ink on virgin plains, to all he met, saw him as a friend. Memories wonderful now fill the page. Many future readings will talk of his name. Silent tears will flow remembering this sage. There is nothing powerful enough to extinguish his name, his flame.
RTÉ's Kevin Reynolds spoke with Seamus Heaney only a couple of weeks ago at the beginning of August.
I used to drop down a wild salmon to him. I'd get a bit of salmon out in Howth every year. And I went down, and for some particular reason, the family were all going to the horse show this year, and I just said, I'll bring in the children. So we said a quick hello to him. And indeed, there, and he was on the way down to the Merryman, and he was on the way up to the Fla. And I said, you're a great man. I just said, who's doing the driving? And he just put his hands up to heaven and said, well, sure. And it was just so typical of the man. He's a huge loss to all of us who knew him. He's a huge loss to people who didn't know him, but knew him through his work. And he's a huge loss to people who will only come to know him in the future, because Seamus will live, like every poet and like every great poet, through his poetry forever.
Our thoughts are with Seamus Heaney's wife, Mary, and their children, Michael, Christopher and Catherine Ann.
From the Republic of Conscience. 1. When I landed in the Republic of Conscience, it was so noiseless when the engine stopped, I could hear a curlew high above the runway. At immigration, the clerk was an old man who produced a wallet from his homespun coat and showed me a photograph of my grandfather. The woman in customs asked me to declare the words of our traditional cures and charms to heal dumbness and avert the evil eye. No porters, no interpreter, no taxi. You carried your own burden, and very soon your symptoms of creeping privilege disappeared. 2. Fog is a dreaded omen there, but lightning spells universal good, and parents hang swaddled infants in trees during thunderstorms. Salt is their precious mineral, and seashells are held to the ear during births and funerals. The base of all inks and pigments is seawater. Their sacred symbol is a stylized boat. The sail is an ear, the mast a sloping pen, the hull a mouth shape, the keel an open eye. At their inauguration, public leaders must swear to uphold unwritten law and weep to atone for their presumption to hold office and to affirm their faith that all life sprang from salt in tears which the sky god wept after he dreamt his solitude was endless. 3. I came back from that frugal republic with my two arms the one length, the customs woman having insisted my allowance was myself. The old man rose and gazed into my face and said that was official recognition that I was now a dual citizen. He therefore desired me, when I got home, to consider myself a representative and to speak on their behalf in my own tongue. Their embassies, he said, were everywhere, but operated independently, and no ambassador would ever be relieved.
Playback on RTE Radio 1 with Marion Richardson.
Welcome back to Playback. It's Bishek Zielinski here. Yesterday morning, we heard a voice long absent from our airwaves. Former Taoiseach Brian Cowan broke his silence and spoke to reporters at an event in Offaly during the week.
No one is suggesting that everyone got everything right. No one is suggesting that, you know, you could foresee everything that happened. But I am saying that there was an honest attempt at all times by all members of our government to deal with the matter in a way which we felt was the best way to deal with, given the unprecedented situation we were in. There is no one more sorry than I about what happened. And, you know, sometimes I get the impression that the request for an apology is in some way that I went out to do something wrong and I should have apologised. The motivation of my government, or any government I ever served in any issue, was to do the very best we could in the very difficult circumstances we found ourselves in. And I've been very frank and open about that, and I've always said, and I don't shift the responsibility from anyone in respect of my role as Taoiseach, the amount of responsibility that I must take and have taken openly and honestly. But if it's a question that, you know, one is to take responsibility for everything that happened in the private banking system or in the international world and financial markets, I think that's perhaps more than is proportionate, something that I should take. But that is in no way suggest that I don't take my full measure of responsibility, whatever that is. But it's not responsibility for everything. And that's the point I've been making all along.
And Brian Cowan's first interview since leaving public life will be shown on TG Cahir on Thursday at 7:30 in the evening. Now, the summer is over. The schools are back and autumn is just around the corner. Michael Finn is the principal of Gorey Community School, the biggest school in the country. He has 1,555 students to look after. Does he know them all?
No, unfortunately, I don't. I know there's a certain percentage whom I know extremely well. A certain percentage whom I know extremely well who are in the office allotment.
All right.
And in their cases, I even know the mammies, the daddies, the grannies, and sometimes the aunties and uncles as well. Unfortunately, and this is a failing really at the moment, but it's something I'm addressing this year, that there are certain students who are in the middle, the quiet, hard-working child, whom unfortunately, as principal of a school of 1,500 students, I don't know.
They're not brilliant enough to be known by you, and they're not bad they're enough not to be known enough. By you.
They're not bold enough. If they were a bit bolder, I'd know them very well.
Father Brian Darcy was on the John Murray show earlier on in the week, and he brought Catherine Thomas back to...
The beginning of September 1957, I had just been lucky enough to pass the 11 plus, and I was entering into St. Michael's College in Enniskillen, in this brand new world, going in on the bus to all these townies and meeting them and trying to find a phrase for myself. And the one thing that I knew I could hold my own on, well, two things, on the football field and about music, because I was a music nut. We had a big wet battery wireless, I'm sure that's now you're talking in antique language to you, but it was a battery, there were two big batteries, they used to have to be charged every now and again. And eventually we got the electricity in our house, and that was great because I could now get Radio Luxembourg 208 in the dial, and and you'd hear all this. And I used to, my father could not get me to bed on a Sunday night because from 11 to 12 was the top 20. And if you went into school the next day without knowing what was number one, you were really the pits, you know. So, and in September, out came Jailhouse Rock. And all of a sudden, the rebelliousness within me got somebody who had it there. This, I never heard anything like this before. This was just absolutely raw brilliance. Elvis was fantastic. He without saying anything, he spoke for the rebel that was in all of us. Warden threw a party in the county jail. The prison band was there and they began to wail. The band was jumping and the joint began to swing. You should have heard those knocked out jailbirds sing. Let it rock. Everybody let it rock. Everybody in the old cell block was dancing to the jailhouse rock. Spider-Murphy.
Elvis Presley, Father Brian Darcy's first idol. But another pop rebel was in the news last week. Miley Cyrus is a former sweet and innocent Disney star who has just changed her image rather dramatically. Last Sunday at the MTV Video Music Awards, she twerked her way into an eye of a media storm. Twerk, you ask?
It's the word of the moment, certainly, yes. Twerking is when you're sort of dancing to popular music in a rather provocative manner, shall we say, and you're kind of thrusting your hips. And of course, it's much in the news just now because of the MTV VMA Awards. So that's kind of a visual definition, if you like, of exactly what twerking is.
So what other new words have made it to the dictionary this year?
Well, selfie is another one from the same kind of area. You know that where you have a photograph that somebody takes of themselves, yep. Mm-hmm. And usually posts on the internet. So, but then we've also, quite interestingly, Omnishambles has made it in now. We chose that as our word of the year last year, which didn't necessarily mean that it would be definitely get into any of the dictionaries. I mean, some do, some don't. But I think that has really proved its worth.
What about FOMO?
Fear of missing out. It's an acronym along the same lines, I guess, as LOL or OMG, although that's an initialism because you pronounce each individual letter rather than give it a pronunciation as a word. Yeah, I mean, I think people can get a little bit perturbed about what they see as the sort of increase in these kind of initialisms. But really, we've been having these for quite a long time. If you think about TTFN, Tata for Now, that sort of goes back to, well, I think the 40s.
OMG, FOMO, YOLO, LOL. Certainly not the acronyms taught at schools, but definitely used by all the students. Fiona McPherson, senior editor of the Oxford English Dictionary, spoke to Catherine Thomas. Now, Colin Kerrigan and Linda Davey had an unusual wedding last weekend. They were the winners of the Mooney Show's wedding competition with the prize of reception at the K Club in Kildare, and they were followed everywhere by Brenda Donoghue from the programme. It all started with a letter Colin sent in to Derek.
I met my beautiful fiancée, Linda Davey, at the end of 2008 after I got back from deployment in Chad with the Irish Army. I fell in love very quickly and I knew she was the one for me. In spring 2010, Linda told me that I was going to be a daddy. The pregnancy was not planned, but I was the happiest man on earth. Unfortunately, our happiness was short-lived. During our 5-1 scan, we found out that our baby, a little boy, had serious heart defects. We decided to name our little man Bobby and we hoped and prayed every day for a miracle. The pregnancy from then on was emotionally tough for both of us, but especially for Linda. To see my beautiful girl so broken-hearted was almost unbearable. On the 6th of December 2010, I took Linda out for a romantic meal and asked her to be my wife. With tears in her eyes, she said yes. Our baby, Bobby, was born by C-section on Wednesday the 15th of December 2010 in Hullough Street. He is the most beautiful little thing I had ever laid eyes on. The image of his mother. Bobby was rushed by ambulance to Crumlin Children's Hospital, and as I promised Linda, I went with him. It broke my heart to leave her behind, but the next day, through pure determination and love for her son, Linda travelled to Crumlin to be with us. At this stage, we hope, beyond hope, that Bobby would make it. On Thursday the 16th of December, the doctor gave us the news that would shatter our world forever. Our little man was dying, and there was nothing that could save him. On Friday the 17th of December, with both sets of grandparents and all our aunts and uncles around us, Bobby was christened. At 7 p.m. that evening, as he lay in his mammy's arms, the angel came and took our angel home. The joy of having Bobby in our lives for just those 3 short days and the utter devastation of losing him changed our lives forever. In September 2013, we were blessed with a little gift from heaven, Bobby's baby sister Millie, who has brought the light back into our lives. So you can only imagine what winning this prize would mean to us.
The wedding day was beautiful and chaotic as they usually are.
Back into the kitchen, Mary, mother of the bride, looking very glamorous.
Oh, thank you.
You have a needle and thread. What's wrong?
Derek, my son-in-law, has just popped a button. So I'm going to try and put it in for him now, if I can see this. At the last minute, everything just seems to be...
Ah, we'll get there. We'll get there.
We still, it's only 25 past, we still have time.
Yeah, okay.
So hopefully...
Hang on, there's a lot of talking up in the corridor while Linda's getting changed. What's wrong, Sinead?
Michelle's going to kill me.
What is it?
Sean Oak's 2 left shoes.
Who's Sean Oak?
The chief bridesmaid's son, and he has 2 left shoes.
What are we going to do?
I don't know. He may go barefoot.
We're walking up the corridor. Linda is ready. We're just walking into the room now to have a look at her in her wedding dress. Oh, Linda, give me a look at you. Oh, you look beautiful.
Thanks.
I just noticed on your bouquet of flowers you have a locket. Do you want to tell me about it?
It's my something old. It's a little like a locket thing that Colin's sister Tracy got me for Christmas. And I have Bobby's photo in it. So he's with me all day.
Oh, let's not start you crying. Nope. We just said it. It's done. Okay.
Catch me tears.
It's important. Yeah. So that's your something old. What's your something new?
My something new is my dress.
Yes. And something borrowed.
My something borrowed is a little thing that Michelle gave me. Little locket thing. And my something blue is on my garter.
Not every engagement has such a happy ending, though. Back in 1913, Miss Emily Sheeran took Mr. Patrick Dignan to court in Dublin in an action for breach of promise to marry.
30-year-old Emily had come up on the train to stay with her friend Mrs. Jane Morrison in Glasnevin and be introduced to Mr. Dignan, the newly attractive bachelor. Jane was in her mid-20s, herself married to an older husband, a manager in the famous Todd Burns department store in Dublin. Now, both Mr. and Mrs. Morrison were enthusiastic about finding a husband for Emily or her sisters, old friends from Jane's Longford days. But young Mrs. Morrison made the easier target.
This lady, Mrs. Morrison, this foolish lady, I should say, started to bring these two together. It was an old saying, and a true one, that it was a foolish thing to sign a bill or make a match.
Is it really believed in Longford that Dignan has £50,000?
I don't know.
On the view, would you take him to be worth tuppence? Now, it is said he looks like a millionaire bachelor.
I never saw one.
But we know that he is like an unshaven orangutan.
I could not say.
Emily Sheeran, no relation, and Sarah Blake looked behind the headlines and uncovered this gripping story for their documentary A Very Brief Encounter. You can download the podcast at rte.ie/doc-on-one. One place couples could go for a quick bite in 1913 was the newly opened Leo Burdock's chip shop in the Liberties in Dublin. It's still going strong, and Drive Times reporter Brian Lally was there to celebrate.
What's great about Burdock's?
Crispy bits.
Yeah?
Yeah.
For those who don't know Burdock's, what are the crispy bits?
They're the bits of the batter that falls off the fish and they mix it in with salt and vinegar and the chips and it's yummy.
Do you ever worry about the old calories or anything like that, or do you make an exception for Burdock's?
Oh, you'd have to make an exception, yeah. No. Calories go out the window when it comes to crispy bits.
When my mother worked in Olympia Theatre, Christmas time she'd do the matinees, yeah, and we'd come over and she'd spend her bonus in Bordocks and we'd have fish and chips. And you know the crispy bits?
Yeah.
They pop a few crispy bits in, salt and vinegar, beautiful. So loads of calories, but beautiful.
Brendan Grace, you'd be a loyal supporter of Bordocks over the years?
I've always been a loyal supporter of Bordocks. That's why I'm so slim.
Yeah.
It's the smallest chipper in the world.
Yeah.
And yet it's the busiest.
Yeah. Would Butler be a fan of fish and chips, you think?
Well, the reason I'm here is to get the lumpy things, the crispy bits. That's the great thing about it.
There's a certain magic to eating fish and chips. If you put fish and chips on a plate and eat it in a fancy restaurant, it doesn't taste as good as licking your fingers when you're finished.
Another important and altogether more serious centenary this week is the commemoration of the 1913 lockout. It lasted for 6 months, with 20,000 workers either locked out or on strike. Historian Anne Matthews told us about this often forgotten aspect of the lockout.
One of the unintended aspects of the lockout, and it's something that nobody ever talks about, is that people didn't have enough money to buy soap. They couldn't wash themselves. Their lives became degraded by the lack of being able to wash themselves properly. Keeping fleas at bay, keeping lice at bay in these rotten houses, no carbolic soap to scrub the toilets because they couldn't afford to buy them. And then there are the businesses that closed down. And when people say the businesses, they shrug like, they're businesses. But we're talking about small huckster shops where these people bought their little bits of soap, their little bits of candle, their little bits of tea, and these little shops closed down. And those families also starved.
The 1913 lockout on RTE Radio 1.
And there are about 100 lockout podcasts available on rte.ie/radio1/lockout. Music was at the centre of the events of 1913. Francis Devine is a Labour historian and a singer. He performed one of the songs popular during the lockout on Arena.
Who fears to wear the red hand badge upon his manly breast? What scab obeys the vile command of Murphy and the rest? He's all a knave and half a slave who slights his union thus. But true men like you men will show the badge with us. We rise in sad and weary days to fight the workers' cause. We found in Jim a heart to blaze to break down unjust laws. But 'tis a sin to follow him, says Murphy and his crew. Though true men like you men will stick to him like glue.
Jim Larkin is remembered as a great speaker who easily captivated thousands on the streets of Dublin 100 years ago. 50 years later, on the 28th of August 1963, on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C., another great speaker made his mark on history.
I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today.
It's been over a month since George Zimmerman was acquitted for murder of African-American teenager Trayvon Martin. Last Saturday, the son of Martin Luther King spoke in Washington, D.C. about his father's legacy.
I stand here today in this sacred place, in my father's footsteps. I am humbled by the heavy hand of history, but more than that, I like you, continue to feel his presence. I, like you, continue to hear his voice crying out in the wilderness. The admonition is clear. This is not the time for a nostalgic commemoration, nor is this the time for self-congratulatory celebration. The task is not done. Their journey is not complete. We can and we must do more. The vision preached by my father a half century ago was that his four little children would one day live in a nation where they would not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. However, sadly, the tears of Trayvon Martin's mother and father remind us that far too frequently, the color of one's skin remains a license to profile, to arrest, and to even murder with no regard for the content of one's character.
From Wednesday's Drive Time. In many countries of the world, we're still fighting for those dreams of an equal society, and many problems continue. Henryk Piotrowski came to Ireland from Poland. He became homeless and died in an industrial skip which was crushed by a waste collection truck. Alice Leahy is the director of Trust, a charity which works with homeless people. She spoke to Jonathan Clinch on News at One on Tuesday.
He came first to us about 2 years ago. He came, like so many others, in an awful state, maybe having slept out. People who maybe move from hostel to hostel can't get any permanency in their lives. Very much like our own Irish people of a generation ago who lived in places like London and that. And we really have seen over the years people going downhill. The kind of light has gone out of their eyes. And many of these people aren't entitled to any social welfare, but they are entitled to shelter. Strangely enough, I was the last person to say Henryk in Trust. Matt, who works with me, called me to know would I look at this man's feet. Now, they were in a dreadful state. He had his feet and he soaked in a basin of lovely lukewarm water and suds. And they were like, all I could think of when I was walking along the other day when I heard of his horrific death, it was like as if you stood on black plums and they squashed into your feet and you left the skins there in your feet. Now, somebody had very kindly, I think a member of the general public, had very kindly given him a pair of lovely soft shoes. But really, they were of no use without, you know, good socks and washing his feet. And he was very grateful. He went off. He had another cup of tea. He had a shower then afterwards. He had his feet dressed. He got a new outfit of clothes. And he went on his way and said thanks, because they're always very grateful. We don't expect gratitude, but for just something as simple and as basic as that. This was a horrific death for anyone. Death in a skip. I mean, what must have been going through that man's head, even listening to those trucks going around, and also the staff who found him and who were left thinking about that there was a human being in there.
Playback on RTE Radio 1 with Marion Richardson.
Welcome back to Playback. Zbyszek Zielinski here. Throughout the week, the world's military powers have been discussing the possibility of an intervention in Syria following the chemical attack on the outskirts of Damascus. Next month, 115 Irish soldiers are going to be deployed to the Golan Heights between Israel and Syria on a peacekeeping mission. On Thursday's Drive Time, Sinead Hussey spoke to Tim O'Brien, who is second in command on that mission.
The government has decided to send us as a force mobile reserve to the force. The force has been there since 1974 and has a very specific mission which we'll be helping it, assisting it to fulfil, and that is to observe the disengagement of the Israeli and Syrian forces following the Yom Kippur War of 1973. Generally, we'll conduct a range of patrolling, some observation posts. We will work with the Fijian and Filipino battalions which are out there, and we'll also act as a quick reaction force. All of us, as soldiers, normally are fully trained in what we call CBRN, chemical, biological, radiological and nuclear warfare. We have full protective equipment. We are capable of operating our equipment, using our weapons and driving our vehicles in full IPE. So if there is even a threat of an attack, we will don all of this equipment, and that will give us complete protection. So I'm confident that our soldiers are well equipped and well trained and well prepared for any eventuality involving chemical weapons.
Now, Pat Rabbit, Minister for Communication, is seeking submissions on the public broadcasting charge, which is to replace the TV licence. He spoke on Tuesday's Morning Ireland.
I don't believe that we have cavemen in the country. I don't believe that there are people who don't watch television and don't access content on their iPad or their iPhone or whatever. If you look at the statutory impositions, for example, that are on the public service broadcasters in terms of a range of, you know, cultural, public affairs, I think it's fair that everybody should make a contribution to paying for that.
And inevitably, all those cavemen and women took to the phones and called Liveline. Like Mary, who hasn't had a TV for the last 10 years.
Oh, it's been amazing. I've done so much. My friends regularly say to me, what do you do all evening? But honestly, there is no time in the evening. I don't know how I ever had the time to watch TV. I've literally read thousands of books. I've run a few marathons in the last few years. I've taken evening classes. I've learned an instrument. I did wood turning. It's so many different things.
I'm exhausted just listening to you.
I've had the time to do since I got rid of my TV. Off the top of my head, I can name five of my friends that don't have a television. You know, there are people out there. Pat Rabbit doesn't seem to believe it, but there are a lot of people out there that don't watch television.
Okay, Pat Rabbit can't ask this question because he can't be that indelicate with a potential voter, but I can be. Be honest with me now. Would you say that you're a bit of a hippie, or are you very normal and very straight in every respect?
I'm quite normal. I'm quite normal in most other ways.
Okay, so no macrame beads around the house. You don't have lentils with every meal here.
Definitely not. I like my steak and I hate the smell of patchouli oil.
But how do we consume our media these days? Fáchna O'Driscoll spoke to Radio na Gaeltachta's political correspondent John Downing about our changing viewing habits.
Deren an tai de sho doing in yuv, gubil biakas gubildina point fime asna an technoliacht nua is the glushuk globe, nur a hagen shi the walya, is leer gubil octo kuig fin ged de muintu natira a firkant air an shana telefisha an boska sukhunda. Agus nearby in shin ak ta tree telefishine egg. Ní móna an cúigú cuid do muintir na tíra, agus ceire telefíseán ag duine as gach seachta.
Cé bhé telefíseán atá gudsta, John?
Tá rud beag dúfa agus bán ag om sena rud.
Ní chreda mé sin ar fan nóméad, is bregad ar den scohu.
And one thing you don't want to miss, and you'd want to see it in colour, are the upcoming GAA semi-finals and finals. Tomorrow we have Dublin against Kerry, and something about Dobbs going against the Kingdom. Here's a piece written by Rory O'Neill for the Sunday Game and recited by Ross Fogarty.
Question on everybody's lips. What is it about Dublin v Kerry? Is it Hill 16 on sunny days in June, or Fitzgerald Stadium with the green and the gold in bloom? Is it Heffo's Heroes or Jacko's Field, and is it Paddy's Day in September dreaming? Is it U2 or Tom Crean? Is it Bernard Brogan or Brian Sheen? What is it about Dublin versus Kerry? Is it Kevin Moran or Colm Cooper? Or when Paddy Cullen made a blooper?
Oh, the greatest break of all time.
Is it Pints of Black or Kerry Gold? Is it Fortunes Made with Tickets Sold? Is it Molly Malone or Fungi the Dolphin? Is it Ballybunion for the Golfin? What is it about Dublin versus Kerry? Is it Gabe Byrne or the Rose of Tralee? Is it the Bomber Liston or the IFSC? Is it Brendan Behan or John B. Keane? Is it Daniel O'Connell or Stevens Green? Is it Mikey Sheehy or Kieran Whelan? Or Grafton Street with Busker Squealing? What is it about Dublin versus Kerry? Is it Brian Mullins or Paddy O'Shea? Is it the Listowel Races or the Dort de Bray? Is it rural, urban, city, country? Is it Pat Spillane or Eamon Dunphy? What is it about Dublin versus Kerry?
On Sunday Miscellany, Maurice Cashel remembered another GAA match.
On Thursday mornings, a postcard arrived telling me when to meet with Mick Keegan, our driver, outside McBurney's on Aston Quay. The Longford leader on Friday night carried the full team. For a period, I was the regular choice. Then came that Dublin Senior League match in Croke Park and the photographs. Not the one of the goalkeeper bravely clearing his lines, but the four in the back page of the evening press with the captions goal number one, goal number two, goal number three and goal number four. The following Thursday, there was no postcard. On Friday night, there was a new goalkeeper in the Longford leader. I talked to the chairman of the county board. Jimmy Flynn's advice was wise, and gently but firmly delivered. It was only a game. I was young. It was time for me to move on, to get a life.
And you can revisit all the highs and lows of these special weekends in the new book, September Sundays, as heard on Sunday Miscellany, which is edited by Clina Nianduan. Now available for purchase at shop.rte.ie. 17-year-old Joanne O'Riordan from Mill Street in County Cork was born without limbs. Last year, she addressed the world's high-tech sector at the UN and challenged the delegates
to build me a robot. Yes, that's right, a robot. It sounds almost insane, but as a child and even today, I've always wanted and would love to have a robot. The main thing the robot will be doing is picking up the objects I drop, such as a pen, knife, fork, and or my phone. This robot will become my hands and legs.
Joanne has just secured a 50,000 euro donation from the UN to help with building the robot. She shared the good news with Catherine Thomas.
It'll be opening doors and closing doors and opening windows and kind of getting stuff from shelves and stuff like that. Like, just very basic things that people like you or my mother or brothers would take, you know, for granted. And I suppose, really, now that 50,000 came in, we might ask for something crazy, like for it to, make me a cup of tea or something. So, you know, we might go mad and throw in a mental thing as well.
You're going in to do your leaving cert this year, isn't that right?
Yeah, going to do leaving cert.
And then what do you want to do afterwards?
What I'm hoping to go out and do journalism in like UL or DCU or somewhere like that.
So the fact that the robot might be ready by then, you know, would be a huge help to you in college.
Yeah, it would be a good boost. Like, I could live almost independently or with someone else, you know. And I suppose it'd be kind of weird for a college roommate, you know, to be living with me and a robot. You know, I mean, you don't want this massive, like, iRobot kind of thing walking into college with you. You know, that would be a bit weird. You know, you kind of want something that'll be normal enough anyway. And but I suppose, like, looks aren't really important for the actual creators of it. But, looks are kind of important as well to me, and they understand that as well.
More than 120 disabled competitors from all over the world travelled to Kinsale last week to take part in the International Disabled Sailing Championship. Damien O'Reilly went there with Countrywide, and he spoke to sailing enthusiast Sam McCarthy, who is 23 years old and has cerebral palsy.
I recently acquired a boat called a Scud.
Yes.
And I'm currently in the process of adapting it to meet my needs, and This event is giving me a great opportunity to meet people in similar situations and get ideas of how to go about doing that. And what's great about the sailing is that once you're out in the water, your disability is secondary, really, and sort of fades. No other sport that I've participated in before, I've tried various other things, and I always felt it was more about the disability than the ability, and I'm not the sort of person that would feel sorry for himself. Yeah. And I just thought that sailing gives a good mix.
While the competitors gave it their all at the World Championships in Kinsale, other people with disabilities faced problems as the HSE announced another round of cuts.
Louise, tell me, when you opened your post on Friday morning, did you have any kind of inkling that what you saw in there was going to make both you and your husband cry?
No, none whatsoever. What happened to us was we opened a letter from my daughter's day service. She's an adult with an intellectual disability, and she's a very happy client of Sunbeam House Services in Bray, and she goes off on her wee bus every morning at 8:10. She loves it so much. She queues up on a Saturday and a Sunday as well until we can persuade her that it's actually a weekend. And we got a letter saying that forthwith the bus was cancelled. You know, our whole family, it's like a house of cards. Somebody's pulled out the bottom. She goes off on her bus at 8:10. I have the quickest shower in the world, and I'm up the road at my job at 8:30. So I'm not able to actually bring her. And it's the same pretty much with every family. Like, nobody can just sort of completely change their life in a week.
From Liveline with Philip Boucher-Hayes. RTE Radio 1 unveiled its new autumn schedule on Thursday. Audrey Carville spoke to Acting Managing Director of RTE Radio, Jim Jennings, and asked him about the changes.
I think it is a departure because, you know, we have moved, like Claire Byrne is moving to Morning Ireland. Sean is there at 10 o'clock. Anya Lawler and Richard Crowley are there at lunchtime. Like, there are some significant changes for the listeners. There are presenters and talented people that they're used to listening to and they're fond of. So I think we've been strategic about how we've done it. I think we've got a very comprehensive schedule and a good mix of people and programmes and production teams throughout the schedule. I think it will deliver an audience across the day for Radio 1.
I do have to talk to you about the big battle, as it's being called, Sean versus Pat. Are you worried at all that Pat Kenny, that he will take a substantial chunk of that listenership? He has a huge listenership on RT Radio 1.
Well, the beauty of this is we don't actually know. There have been other occasions where people have left and gone to other stations and the audience hasn't travelled. I mean, maybe this will be the instance that changes that trend. We don't know. That's the beauty of it. I suppose that's the excitement of it as
but
well.
But people listen to Pat Kenny because of Pat Kenny.
People listen to Radio 1 because of Radio 1, and they listen to the programmes and the content within the programmes. We have a very strong production team on that programme. I think Sean O'Rourke is a very good broadcaster and an equal of Pat when it comes to news and current affairs. So I don't think that the listeners will be shortchanged when they tune in to Sean on Monday morning.
And Today with Sean O'Rourke goes to air on Monday morning at 10 o'clock. And that's it from me for this week. Tens of thousands of music enthusiasts have been travelling to Stradbally in County Laois to take part in the Electric Picnic. Jerry Fish is curating his own stage at the festival. He dropped into the John Murray Show studio earlier on this week and sang live with Cathy Davey. Here they are with Simon Smith and his amazing dancing bear. Have a great weekend. Goodbye.
I may go out tomorrow if I can borrow a coat to wear. Oh, I'd step out in style with my sincere smile and my dancing bear. Outrageous, alarming, courageous, and charming. Oh, who would think a boy and bear could be well accepted everywhere? Oh, it's amazing how fair people can be. Seen at the nicest places where well-fed faces stop and stare. Making the grandest entrance, Simon Smith and his dancing bear. They'll love us, oh won't they? Defeat us, don't they? Oh, who would think a boy and bear could be well accepted everywhere? It's just amazing how fair people can be. Who needs
money
when you're funny?
The big attraction, it has been leaked. It's Jerry the Fish and his tent of
Simon Smith.